Hi everyone, I'm Pamelia Chia and you're listening to the Singapore Noodles Podcast, your go-to destination to learn about Singaporean food culture. Today I have on the show Gladys Fu, who is the founder of Gladys Fu. Hainanese in heritage, Gladys started selling kueh such as Ang Ku Kueh and Yi Bua when the pandemic struck. In this conversation, we chat about the role that kueh has had in knitting her family together and how we can all preserve kueh making traditions in our own homes. How was growing up for you? Like, were you constantly surrounded by kueh and by traditional foods?
Actually, growing up, not really surrounded by traditional foods. In fact, I think because circumstances back in 1970s, during my childhood days, family circumstances were not very good. So we just got by with what my mom could provide, because my dad passed away when we were quite young. But I remember a grand aunt, my grandmother's cousin, she actually makes the Hainanese Yi Bua for orders. So she takes in orders and everything. And what happens is that she will always make extra and drop them by our place. So I always remember eating those Yi Bua since young. And it's actually a special treat because everybody in my family enjoys it. Like, or those who in my family that likes coconut will enjoy it. So I grew up eating that kueh. Also grew up making love letters the traditional way, that means the charcoal with the mold and everything. So I always remember that my auntie and my grandma and my mom, together with my older siblings, they will start making the love letters from like early in the morning, from like maybe 8 something in the morning. And they would make it in the backyard. And then as the sun rises and then the sun gets really, really hot, they slowly move it all the way to the front yard, you know. So I've always met, and they make a lot to give away to relatives as gift giving exchange. And it will start from like 8 in the morning and only end like late at night. So they used to make a lot. And also because they only had like 5 of the molds, so it was a very slow process. Basically, and then another kueh that I always remembered, my grandma making the nian gao, the traditional way. She used to build this makeshift fire stove using wood, and she will actually steam like maybe a few at one go in this big wok. And also, I always grew up, you know, these are the vivid memories of what I remember as I was growing up. And the nianka would take like a whole day, and sometimes she steamed overnight now. So, you know, it's usually, and using really traditional wood, you know, like she'll go and get from the, there used to be a little monsoon area near my place, or even right now, I mean, at the current place, but now, of course, now it's developed already. So she used to go and collect the wood, and then she used that to steam, use that firewood to steam the nian gao. So it actually comes up with that smoky taste and, you know, smell. So right now, my mom still does it, which in fact, we actually launched it last year on Gladys, my Instagram account. And we use the charcoal steamer. So it's still traditional, but instead of using firewood, we actually use charcoal. Yeah.
Mm. Is it traditional to other families to also use charcoal, or was it something that your family improvised?
My family improvised because no longer we have firewood. The firewood to use to steam. But I think nowadays, commercial, or even if people are making it at home, they use the stove because it's much more convenient. Mm. So gas stove or electric stove over fire. So because the steaming can take a while, maybe an hour or so. So they use the gas stove, which is faster. Whereas with the traditional way of using charcoal is about 3 hours long, about 2.5 hours to 3 hours. And you have to always monitor the water to ensure that there's enough water. But of course, the taste is really, really different. Because you do have that smoky, you know, smell and taste to it, you know. So it's really different. So I've grown up eating homemade nian gao. I've grown up eating homemade love letters. And in fact, Yi Bua, after my great grand grand aunt passed away, we stopped having it because she no longer supplies us with it. So I think my family and I missed that lah. So that's when I decided to try and recreate it based on memory of the taste of the ipua. So I did it quite a few times. Of course, my siblings were my critics. I would say critics because they were like really telling you, no, it's not up to standard. No, the skin is bad. No. So it took me quite a few years and many rounds. So each time when I tried it, if it's not up to the standard, it's kind of like, I feel like, you know, it's the self-esteem of trying to recreate it, you know, drops tremendously. And then I just don't want to touch it anymore. And then, you know, like, I must have that the mood to try and recreate it again, to try it again. So it was many years of trial and error, to be honest, before I got, especially my brother's approval, because my brother's the biggest critic. So
yeah, I feel that a lot of Asians or a lot of Chinese tend to be very critical. Like I remember when I was learning how to make a lot of local dishes, yeah, my mom was very critical. Yeah. You know, her standards were very high. She wouldn't really mince her words. And so for me, that was like a barrier to me learning local food. So why did it take so long for you to learn how to make yi bua? I mean, did you not learn it from your grand aunt as you were growing up?
No, I didn't learn from her because she didn't stay near us. So I actually went to research on how it's done, and I try and simplify it to the way it's being done, because the actual process of getting it done, you need to fry the flour, the glutinous rice flour. You need to make a roux before you add it in and everything. So I thought that was actually very, very troublesome. So I tried to simplify the process and everything, and also and eventually I managed to get to the taste, to almost like, I wouldn't say 100% to my grand aunt's version, but about 80%. I wouldn't say 80-90%. And that's when, you know, my family members said, oh yeah, you know, it really tastes like hers and everything. That's when I thought, okay, that's good. But then I started making it as just for family celebrations, for my mom's birthday. And, you know, occasionally if we feel like eating, then I'll make. So eventually how I started Hui Dis was last year during Circuit Breaker in Singapore. I made it because, you know, I had some free time at home. So it so happened that a chef friend of ours actually came by with a loaf of sourdough. And, you know, it's like, it's not nice to just let somebody go off with an empty-handed. So I decided to let her try the ipua. I happened to make some. So she tried it, and it was her first time trying it. And she says it's really, really good and that I should totally sell it. So that was how the entire thing happened. And so because the chef is actually my husband's friend, so my husband said, oh really, she can sell? So he started everything. So he started my Instagram page. In fact, my brand name Kuih Dis is also given by him. And also, you know, so he started posting or doing all the posts, and that's how I got Kuih Dis started. I don't do it full time. I only do it on weekends because I still work. So it's more for my interest. And also as I started, over the last 10 years, my interest in traditional kuehs became even more, grew even further. So that's when I started thinking, you know, some of these kuehs, the tradition is dying. Maybe I should start learning, and also, ipua was not the first. In fact, angku kuih was the first that I learned, and that was from my auntie. And my auntie's in Perth, Australia, so they don't get to eat this kind of kuih. So she actually made it, and then when I was there, she actually told me, oh, I made angku kuih as well. So I asked her to share the recipe with me, and she shared it with me, but I hung on to the recipe, but never made it. I'm more of like a visual person. So when she came by Singapore a couple of years back, I think about 10, 15 years back, I asked her to make and show it to me. So she made it at my mom's place, because she was staying at my mom's, and that's when I first saw it, and then that's when I started learning how to make the Ang Ku Kuih as well.
Yeah, you talked about how the tradition of making kuih is dying. Why do you think that's the case?
I think because young people are not really interested to eat such traditional kuihs. If you look at it, it's more the older folks, but increasingly some interests are growing because people that are making kuihs to sell commercially are actually making different types of flavors, you know, the latest kind of flavors or the latest interests that are that the young people or in fact the current trend. So like for Ang Ku Kuih, it used to be just traditional peanut and the mung beans. Now you have like black sesame, you have matcha, you have durian, you have all these flavors coming in to actually get people interested to try. So they will try, they will buy because it's easier to buy than to make. But if you ask them to make, a lot of people will not want to do it because the process is very, very, very tedious.
That's
true. I mean, all kuihs, like, to be honest, if you want to make, it's a tedious process. So not many people will want to go buy it, go into learning to make it. It's easier to buy. It's easier to buy.
You mentioned about how young people are not interested in eating traditional kuih. Do you feel like local tastes and preferences have shifted, or is it because, you know, now in Singapore people just have so many options that, you know, they might go, I mean, you know, kuih is not exactly the most flashy or the most trendy thing. So is that the reason why you think?
I think that's one of the reasons. And Singapore, to be honest, has got so much options, you know, and we are in competition with all the different types of Western desserts as well. And in fact, different types of different types of desserts, from Korean to Japanese to even the Middle Eastern types of desserts and everything. So in Singapore, it's a food paradise, basically. Everybody is, you know, everywhere you turn, people are looking at, you know, different types of fruits and everything. But you don't really see a hawker center store selling specifically kuihs, you know. So now, I mean, there are quite a few commercial kuih sellers that have come out to make it a little bit more atas, like Harry's Ann. They actually have a shop in
at Tiong Bahru, right?
Yeah, and no, now they have a shop at Suntec City as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You know? Yes, correct. They have a shop in Suntec City as well. Then you have who else? We have Mrs. Kuih that's also doing selling her kuih salads. Then you have all these other
You have like a Galicia pastry in
Yes, in Tiong Bahru, yes, correct. That one is long queue all the time because that's very near my office actually. So yeah. So basically so there are these few shops. Like for the Hainanese desserts, there is one shop in Toa Payoh that Hainan Xiao Chi. They specifically do a lot of the Hainanese dishes and desserts and everything. So they actually do that. But for my children, I have two girls. One is like 17 and one is like 13. I make kuihs at home. They don't even eat it because it's not to their palate, you know. They don't grow up eating it. So, like for me, I've been exposed to it when I was young. So, my girls are only exposed to it like in the last 1.5 years. So, they eat one time, they went, okay, it's okay. But, you know, they will not come back to it because they've been so exposed to all the other options available already.
So do you think this is a strong argument for cooking traditional food at home? Because, I mean, the reason why you would crave for an e-boy is because you grew up eating it. But now, you know, fewer and fewer Singaporeans actually cook at home, let alone traditional dishes. So, I mean, the future generations might not have this nostalgia, you know, or this flavor memory.
I think kids these days are now growing up to burgers, McDonald's, KFC, you know, the fast foods and everything. So the exposure to traditional kuehs is actually lesser than my time. Mm. I mean, my time, you know, like hawker food is not so readily available. You know, you have those people on the carrying the two little,
Bamboo pole and the two buttons.
The bamboo poles, yeah, you know, going around selling carrot cake and everything. So it's like if they come to your area, then you get to eat it. If they don't come, then you won't eat it for a while. So a lot of it is home cooked food. And also for me, because family circumstances then didn't allow us to eat out more. So it was all more mostly home cooked food and all. So the difference is there, basically, I think. It's like, okay, if you talk about the traditional food, my younger ones used to eat like chee cheong fan and chwee kueh, because that's because my husband loves chee cheong fan, so he eats it, and so she's exposed to it, so she likes it. She eats chwee kueh because my mom makes the chwee kueh homemade, so she eats the chwee kueh. So, you know, it's like what you're exposed to when you're young, you tend to continue eating it. But when you're not exposed to it when you're young, then, you know, it becomes something strange. And, you know, at that point, as children or youth this day, they're more independent in terms of thinking. I don't like this, I don't like, don't pass it down my throat. Yeah, you know?
That's so true.
So, yeah, you know, even like my older girl now that she's in poly and she's doing food and beverage business management.
Oh, wow.
I asked her to try my quiz and she's like, one bite and she goes, okay, it's nice, but it's not my cup of tea. You know? So it's really growing up with the foods, basically.
Mm. Mm. So, you know, the last episode on the podcast, I was chatting with Shen Tan, and she was talking about how, you know, sometimes heritage dishes, you know, them being lost with time is inevitable, you know. Sometimes it's a matter of survival of the fittest. So do you see that happening with kuih, you know? And if we were to lose some of these kuihs, would you think of it as like a natural progression with time, or, you know, would you lament the loss of these kuihs?
I would lament the loss of these kuihs because it's really it's really traditional. It's really tradition, and it reflects on the different heritage, as in, like, you know, the Teochews, like the Yipua is for the Hainanese. I mean, funny you mentioned Shen, because she's the one that we gave the Yipua to. Yeah. So she was the one that said I should totally sell it. So it was her first time trying it because she's never tried it before. And so she said, oh, I didn't realize that this is actually something that the Hainanese eat. I said, yeah, you know. There is the Peranakan version, which they call it the kuih kochi, which is similar to the ipua, but the ipua has got like peanuts and everything, whereas kuih kochi is just purely coconut. So that's the difference. So I would feel sad that, you know, some of these kuehs, the tradition dies off and everything, and nobody's taken over.
Mm. But I feel that in modern times, right, you know, since COVID, a lot of home cooks or kuih makers have come out and started this resurgence of interest in kuih.
Yeah.
I see, you know, a lot of heritage food being put on display in restaurants. And that wasn't common in the past. So do you feel that this resurgence was surprising when you first noticed it?
To be honest, it's surprising. But at the same time, I think people, because of COVID, people had more time on their hand because you're homebound all the time. So you need to do something to expel the energy, to keep you occupied and everything. And I think that's where people started looking into, oh, what can I do? You know, and food is actually, you know, you need to eat. You know, you can't go out, but you need to eat. So, you know, people start looking at, oh, what can I cook for the family? Oh, you know, I'm actually Hainanese. Maybe I should try this, you know, and see how it goes. And then you start researching on the internet or on YouTube and see how it gets done and everything. So I think people with more time on hand, people are willing to invest in cooking, home cooking, and looking at, you know, traditional dishes, reflecting their own heritage. Yeah. I mean, if you ask me, if I was pre-pandemic, whether would I be interested to start the kuih business, I wouldn't, because I don't have the time. I don't have the time on hand, or it wasn't my focus then, you know. I learned how to make all these kuihs is actually specifically for my own interest, because I just want to make sure that I know, and then I can pass it down to my children, and my children can pass it down to their children. So it was more for a personal passion rather than trying to make it commercial or to sell it. But it was only during the pandemic that, you know, I was a little bit more free with time, and, you know, to keep myself occupied and not get onto my husband's nerves and my children's nerves, you know. So I started like, okay, let's do this. So, yeah. So like things like the angku kuih, kuih salad, ipua, all these I was already doing it more for like family gatherings, family parties, family birthday celebrations. So I was doing all this. I always make angku kuih for my mom's birthday because, you know, no point buying since I know how to make. And I think it's quite special if you make something for your mom on her big birthdays and all. So that's why I started making them. But, you know, even like recently, this year, my niece got married. So I offered to make the ipua for her, because traditionally ipua is eaten during celebrations like weddings, birthdays, 1 month old. So I made for her weddings and all to be given out. You know, so, you know, it's like it's nice to keep this tradition and also to make it for your family members lah. You
know? Yeah. So if I'm not wrong, in the past, kuih making used to be done as a whole community, right? You know, whether it's making pa zhang or making angku kuih, people, you know, the whole family would gather and one person would, you know, knead the dough and then someone would make the filling or something. But now it seems that the image that is portrayed in the media is that it has become a very solitary endeavor where it is, you know, one person doing everything. How do you feel about that change? Do you sense, I mean, is that change palpable to you?
Yes, it's, I mean, if I ask my children whether they want to learn, my daughter who's in food and beverage management, later, mommy, later. You know, it's they look at the process and they go, oh god, it's too troublesome, you know, and everything and all. My younger one, if I ask her, she will say, okay, I come and help you. Like with the angku kuih, she likes to come and do the knocking it off from the mold and everything. So she will come and help me sometimes, and after it steams, she'll help me to trim the banana leaf so that it looks nice and everything. So but that's if she's bored and nothing to do, then she'll come and help me. If not, you know, she will be on her device, which young people are always on these days, and, you know, and on their Instagram, TikToks and everything. So these are some of the other external influences that actually takes away the attention and the time. So, I mean, during my time, there's no such thing as internet, you know. So you go outside and play in the park. There's no such thing as computer games, you know. If you want to eat, you have to. I mean, I remember that, you know, when we were making the traditional love letters, we always hung around because there's always those that didn't make it, didn't pass the quality check, so you get to eat it. So, you know, you just hang around there. So, like, for our love letter making, we're quite happy that our next generation, as in like my nieces, the older ones, they actually shown an interest because they've seen all the aunties gather together to make the entire family, like in fact my siblings and I, gather together to make it and then give it to everybody that we want to give to. So they actually took an interest to it, and they actually started helping out as well, until of course the pandemic broke lah. So we kind of we can't make it. So
I saw your family photo of you guys making love letters, and when I saw the photo, I was like, wow, this is an image that is so hard to come by in Singapore these days, because not many families still hold on to that kind of tradition. Mm-hmm. When your kids grow up, they'll look back and they'll feel that it's a very precious experience because not many people have it.
Correct. I mean, I totally agree, because when we make this love letters pre-pandemic, when we all will go over to my mom's place and help out, because I come from a family of six of us, six siblings plus my mom's seven. So it's just nice, you know, that, you know, we have everybody in the different areas. Like, I'm in charge of rolling it. My elder sister is in charge of removing the love letter from the mold to pass it to me. Then one of my sisters is in charge of monitoring, and my second sister is in charge of scooping it. It used to be my mom, but my mom is so old now, so we retire her. So she will do the scooping. And then my brother is the fire watcher. So, you know, he'll watch the fire and to ensure that, you know, the fire is consistent so that, you know, the process is ongoing and smooth flowing. So actually, there's one year that, I think in 2020 Chinese New Year, my sisters were saying that, oh, you know, maybe we shouldn't make this year, lah, you know, everybody's a bit tired. So I said, okay, you know, let's not make. My husband was the one that said, hey, even if your sisters don't make, why don't you just borrow the stove from mom's place and you make it outside our house? You know, just maybe make a small batch, you know, maybe just borrow one stove with the five molds and then, you know, get the girls to help you. So I went, oh, okay, maybe I could do that. So I was just talking to my mom and my brother overheard. Then my brother said, no. Why don't we just make some? Just call the other sisters and ask them all to make as well. So actually, with the intention of not making in 2020 before the lockdown, we actually made because my husband wanted to keep the tradition alive of making love letters with your family and to get my children involved as well as a bonding activity.
I think that's so beautiful that, you know, you have your partner to spur you on. So, like, you know, when one party is like feeling, you know, I don't want to do it, then the other one can encourage. And I can totally relate to that because I'm based in Australia right now. I'm living in Melbourne. And when I first moved here, I told myself I don't want to do anything for Chinese New Year, you know, after all those Chinese New Year spent in Singapore that is like really hectic, right? It would be nice to just not do anything. But when the day actually came around, I suddenly felt like something was missing. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized that even something as simple as making some stock and then using it as a hot pot really makes such a big difference, you know, in celebrating or, you know, just creating that sense of togetherness.
Yeah. I mean, I have a cousin that's staying in Melbourne as well. And he is into a lot of this celebration family because he gets a bit lonely there because his own family is back in Perth. And, you know, so he always wants us to go and visit. And he and his wife actually celebrates Chinese New Year. You know, they will send us photos of, you know, like, you know, my cousin-in-law's floral arrangement and, you know, and all that. So the celebrations and everything. Then my auntie in Australia will also celebrate with her girls. And she will also make the pineapple tarts and everything. And my cousins who are staying near her will actually go and help her with the pineapple tarts. And in fact, the nieces and nephew, those that are free and not in school, will also help her to come and make the pineapple tarts and things. So it's like a bit of a family bonding and also tradition. So like my cousin-in-law in Australia, in Melbourne, she also learned to make the ang ku kueh from her mother-in-law, whom I learned from as well. So she will show me, she will send me pictures of her ang ku kueh she made. And then even like my auntie's birthday, and if she's in town in Perth, she will make for my auntie's birthday and all. So, you know, it's really nice. I think my siblings and us, you know, we have this special bond because we grew up with very little. And so the bonding is there, the sacrifice that all my siblings made for each other, even for us when we were growing up. So we really appreciate it. And the fact that all my brother-in-laws is that, oh, there's no other family that we know that is so close, you know, that you guys are so close. So that's why we have a lot of these family activities. Pre-pandemic, every Sunday without fail, all of us will head back to my mom's house. And so my mom's house will have like close to 30 people, including the nieces and the nephews. And, you know, the older ones will hang out together. The younger ones will play together. Then, you know, the sisters and the in-laws will just sit down, chit-chat, can talk about anything. And then my mom and the helpers will be busy cooking, or my sister-in-law will be busy cooking. You know, and then we have dinner together. So that is what we do every Sunday without fail. You know, it's it's that family closeness like that brings everybody together, and it brings cooking together as well, to be honest.
Mm. I love your story, and it makes me so nostalgic and so homesick, because my maternal family is actually very similar to yours, in that so it was a big family. So my mom had six, seven siblings. And, you know, when I was growing up, the food, I mean, because, you know, it was a big household and it was a big family. So a lot of the dishes that I remember from my maternal side, they're very simple. You know, it's a lot of frugality in the cooking.
Mm.
So even things like fish eggs, you know, my papa, she'll like dip it in cornstarch and deep fry it. Or, you know, just simple things like cracking open a durian. I mean, small things could feel like a feast, yes. You know. And I feel that that is so emblematic of that time.
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel that that kind of difficult growing up years influenced the kind of food that you guys ate as a family?
Definitely, yes. As what you mentioned, you know, like food we ate were like just simple fried fish, a vegetable, and meat, and maybe a meat dish. I mean, that would be what all of us would cook. I mean, my younger sister, myself, and my fourth sister, we are just like 1-2 years apart from each other. I think between me and my fourth sister is 3 years, between me and my younger sister is 2 years. So we are like the younger ones, and then between my fourth sister and my brother is 5 years. So when my dad passed away in the 70s, we were still very young. My younger sister was only 4 years old, I was only seven. So we really, really grew up with not having much. And then we started, we were forced, I would use the word forced, we were forced to cook when I was 13, and I hated cooking. I really hated cooking, because when you're 13, you want to go out to the park and play. You don't want to like, 6 o'clock, I gotta go back and prepare dinner for everybody. So me and my siblings, we really hated cooking, and then we had to like cook, we had to clean the house and everything. So that was when I reached young adulthood, I refused to go into the kitchen, because my mom stopped working, so she was like cooking and everything, you know. And then after studies, I started working, so, you know, didn't have time to take up cooking. Only took up cooking again, or revisited cooking, was when I got married, and you have no choice but to cook, because if not, your mother-in-law will frown upon you. And I happened to marry a Peranakan. My mother-in-law is a Peranakan. My husband is Eurasian. My mother-in-law is a Peranakan, and she is so picky. She's like, she behaves like a matriarch. So, you know, and her standard is very, very high. And I used to get very insulted when I cook something and she goes, not enough salt. And she'll literally take the soya sauce and, you know, put it in front of you. And like, you know, it's not salty enough. You know? So it used to like, well, you know, I used to be like, but I think it's salty already. And I asked my husband, it's salty right here. And yeah. To her, you know, everything is not perfect, lah, you know. So yeah, typical, very typical. So I grew up with that. But, you know, it was living with her whereby I pick up some of the Nonya dishes as well.
Mm.
You know, like her pork chop, her babi ponte, her Nonya curries, her Nonya chap chai. So these are some of the recipes that I picked up from her when she was staying with us, lah. So that's where my interest in cooking started coming out again. But then, of course, with work, it was really, really difficult to cook. So I need to cook on weekends. And it does help that, like what you mentioned, lah, that your partner is also interested in food. So my husband actually likes to cook as well. But he likes to do all the Western stuff. So he does all the steaks, the roast beef, sous vide this, sous vide that. So he does all those. Whereas I'm into more of the local foods like mee siam, laksa, stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but actually Hainanese food culture is very intertwined with all these like Western classics, yes. Right? I mean, there's a lot of influence from Western cuisine.
Yes, because traditionally back in the 70s, 60s, during the colonial days, I would say, a lot of these colonial families will have a Hainanese cook. So the Hainanese will learn the Western style of cooking, different types, and they were incorporated into Hainanese food. So if you look at Hainanese pork chop, there is mixed vegetable, with French fries. Mm. So the pork chop is actually Hainanese, but the sides are actually very Western. Mm. So like they have a mutton stew or they have the beef stew. It's actually very Western. But they actually brought it and then they add the Hainanese influence into it, basically. Yeah, so these are some of them.
So what is the Hainanese influence?
I think it's just, let's say, beef stew, how you upgrade it. So they added potatoes, they added carrots. You know, so they made it what they picked up from who they work with. And in fact, if I'm not wrong, a lot of Hainanese men were sailors as well. So they sail around the world. So they are exposed to the kind of food. And then when they finally settle back down in Singapore, that's how they become cooks. So a lot of them are actually cooks in colonial families. So these are some of the like beef stew. Then they would upgrade it by using lamb. So you have a lamb stew. You never think of using beef, but because they see people eating lamb and the English eating lamb stew and everything, they incorporate that in as well. So they change the meats, the protein from a beef to a lamb. So that's how they did it. I mean, like crackling pork, which is like siu yok.
Mm.
But they call it crackling pork. So my mom's older brother was actually a chef in, I think, American Club a couple of years ago. Many years ago. And he actually learned to make the crackling pork. And then he then actually, how should I say?
Put his own spin to it
to our own siu yok. I mean, if you go outside to all these Cantonese, Teochew restaurant, the siu yok crackling is actually just using salt and oil to crackle the skin. But my uncle added flavors in. He has mustard. He has ginger, he has garlic, you know, that's the marinade for the entire meat and the skin. Then after that, he'll wipe it down and then he will add salt and everything, the normal crackling process and everything. Yeah. So my mom, he taught my mom how to do it. So my mom actually does a very good siu yok, which my entire family loves. So I'm still learning. I still cannot perfect the crackling yet. I did it a few times. The very first time I did, the entire skin disintegrated from the meat. So I'm like, Mom, what happened? She went, oh, you cannot use fresh pork. You must use frozen pork.
Oh my gosh. Why?
I don't know why. She just told me you cannot. So, you know, some other ways people do is like they parboil it. Then after that, then they crackle it. So it's very different. Mm-hmm. So my mom's one is really the traditional way. So she has it marinate overnight. Then after the next day, she has this process and with baking powder for the skin and the salt. Yeah, so it's really different.
So this is traditional to all or most Hainanese families, not just your family?
I think just my family, not all families. Now a lot of people are just using shortcut ways to crackle the pork. So my cousin in Australia, cousin-in-law in Australia, does a mean siu yok as well in Australia. Mm. But he does it the parboil and then, you know, season parboil and then you crackle it and all. So we tried using his version as well. Not very successful. So I think I'm just gonna continue using my mom's version.
You totally should master that recipe. It sounds amazing with the marinade and then wiping it down and then crackling the skin. But what about for Hainanese kuih? It's like the kuih that is most unique to Hainanese food culture, the ibuah.
Yes,
ibuah. Is there, you know, are there others?
There is one that my mom told me that I should learn how to make, but you know, I need to go to the Hainan Xiaochi to eat it to really know what is it. It's in Chinese, in Hainanese, the Hainanese name sounds very, very crude, but the direct conversion is chicken shit. So my mom said, oh, you have to go and learn how to make the chicken poop. I went, what? Chicken poop? Then she went, yeah, there's this other dish called chicken poop. I went, okay, I'll have to head down to this Hainan Xiaochi to see, because they still sell it. And then, you know, apparently it's made with some kind of bitter veggie or something like that. I can't remember. So, you know, then there's the other version of That's what you call it, the art pua, so which is a traditional Hainanese dish as well. So, you know, it's almost the same as the ipua. But ipua, you actually rolled it and, you know, you wrap it in banana leaf. This one, using the dough, you actually cook it in the water. You actually cook it, then you dish it out and you coat it with the coconut filling. So that is the other one, ipua.
Yeah.
But I think there is this shop in Singapore, this which is, I think, the second generation from the Hainan Xiaochi. They actually made it into a mochi version. So they do it into a little ball, glutinous rice ball, but they roll it, they coat it with the coconut outside.
Is this all things Hainanese?
Yeah, the next generation, correct. Yeah, so they also started that as well. There is actually another restaurant here in Singapore. I'm not sure whether you heard of them. British Hainan.
I have.
So their food is really, really good. In fact, British Hainan actually asked me whether I wanted to collaborate. And, you know, this was like pre-pandemic. Whether I wanted to supply the ipua to them to sell. But I was not confident in doing it more commercial. So I kind of like said no. I mean, it took me a while to... And it was actually, I never intended to sell my kuehs, basically. It was actually Shen that actually encouraged me that we started. So,
but I think it's so great that you actually did, because I feel that Hainanese kueh hasn't been in the spotlight much. Yes. I feel that people don't really know much about it.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I think the pandemic has actually... made the resurgence of kuih. So I think the pandemic was good and bad in bad because, you know, there was total shutdown, but I felt that it was really, really good in terms of creating time for family, and families were bonding together over food. I mean, actual immediate families. Like, for me, it was important because my kids used to have dinner at my mom's house before they come home, together with my helper, because I'm working, my husband's working, so
yeah.
The kids are actually my mom child minds for me, together with my helper's help. So after school, they go to my mom's house, so they eat what my mom cooks, basically, which is what I eat anyway. So then my husband and I, if we sometimes we eat together, sometimes he will settle his own dinner, I will settle my own dinner, or eat at my mom's place, then the kids come home, so we don't really have meal time together. It's only on weekends. But with the pandemic, there was a lot more meal time together. There was a lot more conversations, laughter, troubleshooting of emotional problems from the kids and everything, you know. So, you know, good in that sense whereby it forced families to be together, but bad because, you know, of the shutdown and everything, you know. But so I saw it as more positive, lah, you know, than negative, that, you know. I had more time with my family. My husband was working from home all the time, so he's always around. And then, I mean, that's how we started. I mean, that's how I started the Kuehdis as well.
That's fantastic. So, I mean, on a more personal level, how has this journey really transformed you? Do you feel that it connected you more deeply with your Hainanese heritage? You know, did you have any shifts in perspectives?
It made me want to learn a lot more about what are some of the Hainanese traditional food. I have people asking me whether do I sell Hainanese dumplings for Duan Wu Jie. I went no. I wanted to learn, but my mom told me don't, because making bat zhang is, once you start, it's going to be a lifelong thing. You cannot stop. So I like, huh? She went, yeah. That's why your grandmother. You know, when your grandmother started making it, we have no choice but to make it every year. But when your grandmother passed away, we decided, we took it as an opportunity to stop making the bat zhang.
What do you mean by you cannot stop?
I don't know. I don't know why she said you cannot stop. It's something which you will need to continue to do till, you know, thy kingdom comes. So I didn't ask further, but that's what she said. And my sister echoed. She said, yeah. And I still remember, like, the bat zhang, now that, you know, we talk about bat zhang, I still remember the bamboo poles, you know, where we used to hang the clothes, you know, the bamboo the clothes stand that were used to hang the bat zhang. And again, my grandmother used the wood burning stove that she makes for the niankao. She used the same thing. She'll make one, makeshift one, and then she'll steam her bak chang like that as well. So those are my recollection, and it's really traditional. So again, that smoky smell, everything comes in. So for me, I'm quite lucky. I have both Hainanese and some of the Nonya influences because of my mother-in-law. So like things like kueh salat, you know, I learned, it's not something I learned from my mother-in-law, but I started eating them because my mother-in-law, when I was dating my husband, she used to have them on the table and I used to eat it. She doesn't really make them. She actually buys them, but you know, but the exposure is there. So then I begin, oh, I like this kueh. So then I started learning to make it. And then over the years, because of my work as well, that's where I started to be more interested in food again. Yeah, that's how everything came together.
Yeah, I feel like your generation and, you know, to some extent my generation, we are so lucky in that, you know, we live in a time where when we come home, there's like traditional food on the table, like kueh. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, sometimes I speak with my cousins or my younger brother, so they are like in their teens, right? Or early 20s. And they would tell me things like, oh, what is ang ku kueh? Or like, what is kueh pai tee? You know what I mean? And I feel that there is already that loss. Like with every generation, there is so much that is being lost. So how do you feel we can, you know, try to preserve it or keep it going?
I think exposure to our children, like for me, which is what I'm trying to do, to expose them. And in fact, my husband is encouraging, expose them to it. So like the making process, the taste, and then the stories behind it, you know, sharing with them the stories behind it, how this came about, or how did mommy started making this kueh, and what this kueh signifies and everything, what is it? And, you know, like not many people are doing it, you know, and it'd be good that, you know, you can continue this tradition and all. And, you know, with my older girl, the one that's doing this hotel, food and beverage management, I often tell her, you look at, you know, these, she watches a lot of Netflix program on cooking and everything. I say, look at all these, you know, it's all tradition, you know, like these three brothers, you know, their passion for food actually derived from the mom's cooking and everything. Mm-hmm. And they became cooks and everything. It's because of the exposure since young. And to be honest, I think if you look at chefs around the world, a lot of them have traditions behind them, which is family, a mother, that grandmother, her parents cooking and everything. I mean, if you look at Chef Shen, she's also coming from somebody whose parent is actually who runs a food business at what's that hawker center, the one that is near Chinatown,
Maxwell
Market. Yeah, so. You know, so there's a lot of these, you know, exposure to it. So the more we expose our kids to it, I think the interest is slowly picked up, basically.
Yeah. So you talk about the importance of exposure. And I mean, you have been doing that for your children since the pandemic because you have more time. But the thing is, you know, when everything goes back to a new normal and people start having less time, how do you think it's practical for us to expose the younger generation to foods in the traditional foods in the home setting?
I think, to be honest, people like me who are into traditional kueh makings and those other cooks out there, maybe we should come together and do workshops that would interest young people. Or to expose. I mean, if you look at, you know, out there in the market right now in Singapore, there's always cake baking workshops, bread making workshops, there's cake decoration workshops, soap making workshops. You know, so maybe if we can get chefs to actually do a traditional kueh making workshops, but appealing to the young. Younger means maybe the teenagers or even children. You know, when you expose them when they're young, and they might find that, oh, it's actually quite fun. But unfortunately, you need to fine-tune the process because some kueh making process is actually very long.
Yeah.
Like your kueh salad, you need to soak the, you know, the glutinous rice for at least 2-3 hours. You know, then, you know, the process of extracting the pandan juice. And you talk about traditional, you have to use the traditional way of doing it, as in extracting the pandan juice. You cannot say, oh, you know, let's do the shortcut way, use the pandan paste, because the taste is totally different, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so things like this. So you need to find a way to simplify the process so that it fits the amount of time for a typical workshop.
Yeah, but I think at the same time, kueh making is so different from, say, pastry making or cake making.
Yes.
I used to work in kitchen, so I'm used to manual labor. But when my grandmother-in-law taught me how to make her peng kueh and her angku kueh, it's just like hour upon hour of pressing, you know, molding the kueh and then pressing it, knocking it out. It's like so repetitive, and I felt that it was quite torturous, to be honest. And it's different from making a cake, because making a cake, you just like make the batter, put it in the pan, put it in the oven, and that's it.
Yes, correct. So basically, I think you are totally right. Because when I started making the angku kueh, like for my mom's birthday, I have to make 60. I'm like, oh God, when is this going to finish, you know, and everything. But the thing is that because now that I make it so often, I have that process in
the muscle memory.
Yes, you know, it's like, I need to do this. And because you do it so often, it becomes like natural, and also the utensils you use are lesser. To be honest, I don't use soap. When I first started, I remember I had my entire countertop would be filled with utensils, and then the tedious of, you know, having to wash is so tedious, you know, washing every utensil. But right now it's like, okay, this is the only thing. So like for my kueh salad making, I only use two bowls, two soup bowls and one stirring bowl. That's it.
Wow.
And also you got that, you get that process, you know, you streamlined it and everything. So I mean, when Singapore Heritage Fest actually approached me and asked me whether can I do a demo for them, I had to tell them that let me think about it, because I need to streamline the entire process into an hour and a half workshop. How am I going to do that? So I had to go back to her and say that I cannot show you the entire process. I can only show you pictures of how the filling is made, being made. I can show you the made filling, and then I can make the dough on the spot, because that's easy. But you know, so I had to streamline the entire process so that I could squeeze it into an hour and a half. And so if you want to conduct traditional kueh making workshops, that is what people have to probably do, how to streamline the entire process so that it can be conducted within the hour, and people wouldn't look at it like, oh my God, it's so tedious, I don't want to do this anymore. I mean, when you make the peng kueh, you're like, oh my God, it's like so tedious, I don't want to, you know, make this, you know, just once in a while and everything and all that. Not. So I will want to try it. So I think it's about and making it interesting, making it more fun, so that people will pick up. In fact, I do have people asking me whether do I want to conduct workshops, or do I want to, can they come over and I conduct workshops? I went, no, I'm not ready for that yet. I have done a video of kueh salad making, because I did it with three of my friends. They wanted to learn. And after they went, oh my God, Gladys, the process is so long. Can you just make and we buy it off you when we feel like eating? We order from you. Yeah, okay. You know, so you know, when they get daunted by it, they're like, oh my God, it's so long, you know. You mean I have to steam for 45 minutes? You mean I have to soak the rice for half an hour, for 3 hours? And what if I don't soak the rice and everything? So, you know, all these questions and all. You mean I have to stand here and stir for 10 minutes, you know? And I cannot even guarantee that the consistency is correct, you know? So it's like, so I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
So I say, yeah, it's easier to order. And, you know, in Singapore, it's easier. It's quite easy to buy all this food. Yeah. But unfortunately, a lot of these food that you buy commercially out there is actually factory made, machine made. It's not so, you know, handmade or personalized.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel that, you know, the quality of kueh that we have now, you know, after COVID is so vastly different from, you know, say what you get factory made kind of ways, you know, from shops in the past. So yeah, I mean, I'm very excited to taste yours when I'm finally back in Singapore, because my knowledge of Hainanese kuih is not really there, and I don't think I've had really good versions of, say, an yibua in Singapore. So can you tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you, or you know, if they want to order your food?
They can visit my Instagram, which is kuihdisfu, at kuihdisfu, currently, because I'm still doing it part-time, because I'm still working. I only make on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, because I work Mondays to Thursday. And orders have to be 3 days in advance, basically, so that it gives me time. I even buy my ingredients fresh. I don't buy and keep it for the week, you know. So if I need, I buy what I need, so I don't have to store them in the fridge. So basically, it's all fresh.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was great listening to you share about, you know, especially how COVID has, you know, literally changed your life, and also to hear about the family stories, I found that very heartwarming. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, hopefully we see you when you come back to Singapore, if there is a chance.
Yes,
yeah, I'll definitely make some kuehs for you, definitely.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You have been listening to Gladys Fu, who is the founder of kuihdisfu. If you're looking for last-minute gifts, the food publication arm of Singapore Noodles, Seasonings Magazine, has Christmas bundles available for purchase. Each comes with three spices blended by Jaya Seelan, who is a spiceman who operates out of a wet market. So we have fish seasoning by Orang Lawit SG, a satay seasoning by The Soulful Cook, and also a granola seasoning by Moom Health. Everything is wrapped together with a block-printed cloth that is repurposed from Ray Crafted's production leftovers. If you'd like to purchase a bundle, visit seasoningsmag.com. To stay updated with more news from Singapore Noodles, visit our website at sgpnoodles.com or sign up for our newsletter at sgpnoodles.substack.com. That is S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K. Once again, thank you for listening to the podcast, and I'll catch you next week.